love espresso, drip coffee, and cold brew? With the Ninja Luxe Cafe, if you can crave it, you can brew it. Espresso? Balanced. Drip coffee? Rich. Cold brew? In a flash. With Barista Assist technology, you brew with no stress and no guesswork. And make perfect silky microfoam, hands-free, from dairy or plant-based milks. Bring the coffee house home and unlock your favorites with the Ninja Luxe Cafe.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back to the Bonfire Podcast, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts with those closest to the fight game. I am your host, longtime MMA journalist and MMA junkie senior reporter, Mike Bond. We have a very fun show for you guys today. After a very important weekend, I thought, in the world of UFC, we had Kamaru Usman get a massive victory in the UFC Atlanta main event over Joaquin Buckley, Rose Namajunas getting an important win over Miranda Maverick in the co-main event, another former champion on that card, and Cody Garbrandt suffers a loss to Haoni Barcelos in his first fight after signing a new contract with the UFC. Thought that might be Cody's last one after it was originally the final fight on his deal, but signed something new, and I think we will see no love here for a few more fights at least. But that kind of set the table for this busy close to the June schedule. Of course, UFC Baku and Azerbaijan, the Octagon debut there, going down on Saturday. Big main event there at light heavyweight between Jamal Hill and Khalil Roundtree. Very much looking forward to that one. Spoke to both guys before this. You can check out those interviews over on MMA Junkie, along with many others I've done in the last week or so. It has been very, very, very busy times, you guys. A lot going on. Obviously, have to throw it back to last week and the amazing tribute show we did for my late friend, Jordan Breen. The feedback, the reception was incredible. It really touched my heart to just see how many of you shared your memories in the aftermath and said how it kind of brought you back to those Sherdog Radio Network days. Being tough dealing with the fallout of all this, but it's really been uplifting to see all the support, especially over on the GoFundMe for the Jordan Breen Scholarship Fund. If you had not donated that to that yet and are willing to do so, the link is in the description of the video and audio versions of this podcast. Please consider, every penny counts. It would mean a lot to me. So that leads us to today's show, everyone. And we are going to have the return of Dean Thomas, UFC analyst, oftentimes commentator there in the coach's spot on the broadcast, and of course the many great works he does around the industry, SiriusXM, Fight Court podcast. It's always a treat when we have Dean here because he is not reluctant to give his opinions, and we have a lot of stuff to give opinions on here today, starting with Atlanta, going into Baku, spinning ahead to next week, International Fight Week, UFC 317 in Las Vegas, a huge one, Ilya Topuria versus Charles Oliveira for the vacant lightweight title. And then a few other things, maybe a little way too early Fighter of the Year discussion with Dean, a very fun game attached to that. So please make sure to stick around for that. And we will close it out with a little John Jones, Tom Aspinall, Francis Ngannou, heavyweight division talk. Hopefully the end of this painful saga is nearing its end. So a loaded show for you guys today. Please make sure to like, subscribe, rate, comment, whatever you can do to offer support on video or audio platforms. It means a lot as we try to continue to grow here on the Bonfire. I'm going to take a quick break now, and I will be right back with Dean Thomas. Once again on the Bonfire, it is Mr. Dean Thomas, one of the great analysts. You see the Fight Court sweater you got there for your great podcast with Ryan Quinn, man. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. It's good to talk to you again. I'm surprised you're having me back on, so apparently we're friends. I'm like, man, this dude don't like me, but I'm glad we're friends, and I'm glad we get to chop it up.
Yeah, come on, Dean. I think you're the most frequent guest of the show now, almost. You're probably in a deadlock like you and Luke Thomas or something. So you have a home here as many times as you want it.
Boy, the Thomas boys are representing.
No exactly.
Doubt. Yeah. No doubt.
There you go. I didn't even put that together. Great, great way to say. But we're here, Dean. We want to talk to you about five things that I put together in the UFC just going on right now, some hot topics. Of course, I want to start with what we saw this past weekend in Atlanta, Kamaru Usman. We talked about this fight last time you were on, and your quote I thought was great. It wasn't hating on Kamaru, but I think it was what a lot of us thought. You said, more than anything else, Buckley seems hungry for the opportunity. He's hungry to show what he can do. You've got a guy like Kamaru Usman who's not as hungry because he's already been fed. He ate already. He's just trying to get seconds. He's older. I don't know. I'm hoping he can go out there and put on a good fight, but I don't know. And I think a lot of us didn't know. What did Kamaru Usman prove to you on Saturday?
Man, he proved to me that he's still got a lot of left. I mean, he looked fantastic. I couldn't, as I'm watching this fight, I'm like, man, he looks really good. He looked amazing. And I had to give him his props. And I texted him afterwards. And would you like me to share that text?
I would love that?
Yeah. All right. Let me see if I can pull that up. I wasn't going to do this, but I mean, it's if I can't, I got to find it. Where in the hell is that text message? But as I'm finding that, I just want to talk about his performance. I mean, he looked so good in terms of like everything. He reminded me of, and I told him this, of an old school Bernard Hopkins. Just extremely intelligent, extremely smart, understanding what it is that he wanted in the fight. And he took advantage of a lot of the deficiencies of Joaquin Buckley. And he showed that Joaquin Buckley still has a lot of holes in his game. And Kamaru Usman just went out there and took it to him. Damn, I can't find this text message. I'm sorry, Mike. I'm gonna find his message. But
did you text it to him? Did you DM him it on Instagram?
No, I texted him personally, so it's here somewhere.
How quick does Kamaru Usman respond to your texts?
Believe it or not, he actually responded in a timely fashion. Now there was a time where my man would not respond to me at all, or at least in a timely fashion. But now I think we on that level where we're responding. Like, so I have this issue, man, where I delete my text messages, and I know what you're thinking, you know, man, I'm a dirty dog, right? But that's not the case. But I always end up deleting my messages.
Well, give me the gist. It's okay. What did you do?
So basically he just said, basically Kamaru was like, stop underestimating us old killers. You know what I'm saying? Like, and that was the thing. And I'm never going to stop underestimating the old killers. I can't do that. Right. But what I can say is that when one does have a performance like this, I have to take my hat off to him. Right. So typically it's not normal that older guys perform this way. It's not normal. So Kamaru's different. So it's not normal. So the fact that he coming off three losses, facing a guy who had the potential to really steal his thunder and steal his shine, Kamaru went out there and put together a performance that I don't know if I've ever seen him look as good as he did against Joaquin Buckley. Just good and hungry, even from the beginning, like from the stare down. I mean, he looked absolutely amazing.
Yeah, he did. He really did. I would put this up there with some of his better performances. I mean, of course, there's been like, it's hard to top the KO of Masvidal and all that stuff. But
that's just one punch, right? That's
exactly. Yeah,
that's one shot. I mean, but we're talking about like just performance of just nonstop, like almost. In my opinion, I'm different from most people the way they score fights, but I'm like, look, these were like almost 10-8 rounds.
Yeah, I thought a couple of them were. What do you think Buckley figured out late in that fight in the fifth round where he was able to do it? Was it more maybe Kamaru losing a little something after working so hard that first 20 minutes?
Well, I mean, it's just, I think Buckley figured out that he needed to work a little harder. Like he needed to work, he might have. And not that I think he underestimated Usman. I do think that he might have thought it could have been easier. Like he probably had in his head what we all thought about Usman. That's the problem. Is that I'm not the only one who thought that Usman might be washed up and done. We all thought that. And Buckley might have thought that. So when he's going out there and get like even after that first round, he's cut, he gets up, he's smiling, like he's probably thinking to himself, like, oh, he still got a little something, but watch this. And then when Usman kept the pressure on, Buckley was like, oh no. And then probably in the fifth round he realized, whoa, I need to really do something because this guy's still a threat.
Yeah, for real. And he wasn't able to get there. He tried. He emptied the tank, like all due respect. And hopefully this is a hard learning lesson for him. But yeah, maybe we got a little too excited after him beating a short notice Colby Covington, that maybe we didn't give Kamaru enough of his respect. But that was a go ahead.
So I found the text. I said, and I sent this to him. I said, might have been the best you've ever looked. Reminded me of Bernard Hopkins on his Big Brother tour. And he responded almost immediately. Probably because I was being nice. He said, thank you, my brother. Stop doubting some of us experienced killers. And then I responded, relax. I will run up on you.
Yeah, no, Kamaru is all, it's nice to see, like, when we get the moments, like you said, it doesn't happen as often as maybe it could, but when you get the Dustin Poirier beating the Benoit Saint Denis in moments like this, it is it's nice, because I think, you know, we see a lot of turnover, but guys like Kamaru, we want to hang on to them as long as possible, because I think they make it more interesting.
For sure. And he gave us a lot of reason to believe that he can continue this run. It's still, yeah. I still have my doubts, but he did give us a lot of reason to believe that he can continue this run.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the question. How far can he continue this run? I saw, you know, Henry Cejudo kind of making the case today on their podcast, being like, if Volkanovski got his title shot after the, you know, couple losses there, Kamaru, a similar situation, bounces back in a non-title fight. But like, if Volkanovski got his shot, why shouldn't Kamaru get it off this win? But welterweight is just so freaking deep right now, and we don't know when we're going to get Islam and Jack Della Maddalena. It seems like there's more things working against him than maybe there was for Volkanovski in his situation.
Yeah, it's tough because no one even considered him to be, like, of all the different scenarios, we never really considered this to be a possibility. Yeah. And if he didn't have the performance that he had, let's say it was like a close decision that he won, it wouldn't even be a suggestion for him to be fighting for a title. But the fact that he completely shut out Joaquin Buckley, I can see him making a case for wanting to fight for the title, but I just think it's just too many guys ahead of him. There's just too many. And that's the problem with, I think, the way we value MMA, is that when a guy loses, we don't really knock him back enough, unless he's like really super, unless he's Bilal Muhammad, but like super unpopular. Then we'll really kind of drop him into the gutter. But a guy like Usman, who's pretty popular, like he had three losses, but he only moved down like two spots in the rankings. And then he gets this win against Joaquin Buckley, who he was ranked higher than. It still opens up that opportunity for him to get a title shot. But I don't know. I know he just told me stop doubting some of us experienced killers, but I have to always side with reality and understand that there's more to it than just the result that happened on Saturday night. I just don't know if he could go out there and do that same type of performance to somebody like Shavkat, Sean Brady. You know, like, these guys they're more dimensional than Joaquin Buckley. Let's just say that they're a lot more dimensional than Joaquin Buckley.
Totally agree. The fight I think you'd have to do is the Bilal one. I mean, it's right there for you. He's ranked number one. He's an older guy too. Like, if you're Kamaru and you win that one, then in my opinion, you're undeniable for the title.
They already got beef. This is the rematch. Like, I want to see the video of the first one. Like, they won't put the video out.
I know they need to put that out. If they get to a fight, I hope they would. But yeah, I mean, would you give Kamaru any chance of beating Jack Della Maddalena or Islam Makhachev? My thing is like, If it is Jack, that means he beat Islam. And I think that would be an extremely impressive win. I don't know how he would do it, but like, I think we would be thinking of Jack Della Maddalena differently than we do here today if he gets a win over Islam, and, you know, all the problems he could cause Kamaru. And then I think Islam's a tough matchup for him regardless.
You know what's crazy to think is that we always talk about MMA math not working, and it doesn't work.
No.
But Usman has the ability to do to Jack what he did to Kamaru Usman for the same exact reason.
Yeah.
For the same exact reason. We're talking about guys who are, like, when you talk about Jack Della Maddalena and Joaquin Buckley, they're not like sophisticated grapplers or sophisticated wrestlers. They're guys who defend the wrestling. And Kamaru Usman is so difficult to defend wrestling against because his arms are so long. And when he wraps up these shorter guys have to get closer to him to hit him. And when they get closer, Usman just pounces, boom, and he wraps him up with his really long arms, which is going to make it difficult for him to fight guys like Shavkat, who's a little bit longer, who don't have to get as close to him, or even Ian Garry, who moves a little bit better than these guys. He might be able to do that to Ian too, because Ian's a little deficient on the ground, I think, as well. But Sean Brady's a little different case. Sean Brady's shorter, but I don't see Usman being able to dominate him on the ground that way. So when I think about Usman and Jack Della Maddalena, it could potentially look like the Joaquin Buckley fight.
Yeah, I agree. Unless, you know, like, obviously we know Islam can grapple extremely well. If he can shut that down, I think that might say a lot to us about how good he is. But that's a absolutely huge task. So we'll see when we get that fight. It needs to happen soon because there's so much freaking happening at welterweight here. So they need all those fights to play out. But Dean, we will move on to thing two here. UFC Baku on Saturday, Jamal Hill and Khalil Roundtree in the main event. By the time this podcast comes out, I'll have one-on-ones on MMA Junkies YouTube channel with both guys. But I don't know, what's your read on this? Like, two former champion, former title challenger, both these guys want to get back to that spot. I expect someone to get knocked out in this fight, probably.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I'm leaning towards Khalil Roundtree to knock out Khalil. I mean, I'm sorry, Jamal Hill to knock out Khalil Roundtree. Let me make that clear. I'm leaning towards Jamal Hill to knock out Khalil Roundtree. And the reason being, Khalil Roundtree looked fantastic against Alex Pereira, but that was...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
His moment. That was his moment. And sometimes fighters just have that moment. And then they go back to what they really are. And I'm not saying Khalil Roundtree is not a great fighter. He's a very dangerous fighter. But I think he rose to the occasion with Alex Pereira, and then we're going to automatically assume that that's his new standard. And I don't, me personally, I don't necessarily assume that that's his new standard. I think he rose to the occasion, but I still think he's a good and dangerous fighter, but not an elite world championship level fighter. I think Jamal Hill has that ability in him. He's a little bit longer. He's got instinctive boxing skills. I think he's going to be able to touch up Khalil Roundtree, as long as he can avoid the leg kicks.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it as well. Jamal seems very serious when I talk to him, you know, like no titles, no rankings talk. It's all just like Saturday, Khalil Roundtree. And there's been a lot of times where it seems like he's got ahead of himself and it hasn't necessarily worked out. But this time he seems absolutely locked in. So I like everything I'm seeing out of Jamal here.
Yeah. I think that Jamal, just since the injury, he hasn't been the same, and he's been trying to find that. And I'm going to give him, I don't know, and you know how I am, man. I'm very cynical of the game, but I'm gonna give him the benefit of the doubt and suggest that he found what he was looking for to get him in the right mental place to go out and put on a great performance.
Yeah, and for Khalil, I mean, like he, like you said, had his moment there, but so many circumstances around that one. Like Pereira took that fight very short notice. He seemingly wasn't healthy. He was on like antibiotics and stuff, and then he gave Khalil a lot of damage in that fight. That's one of those ones that can change your durability and things like that, right? So, do you have any concerns about the impact of that war?
I'm not concerned about the impact of the war. I actually think that might give Khalil a little bit more confidence going into a fight like this, knowing that he was able to sustain the damage from Alex. He's probably thinking, yeah, you know, if I could take Alex's punch, I could take Khalil's punch. Now that works twofold, because he might think that because he took Alex's punch, he could take Khalil or Jamal's punch. That might not be the case. You know, Jamal, you know, just because you take one guy's punch doesn't mean that the next guy can't knock you out. So, but at the same time, it might give him a little bit more confidence, Khalil, a little bit more confidence to stay in the fire and be willing to really explode, because, you know, he's a powerful guy too. Like his kicking game is devastating. He's got good power in his hands. It should be interesting. If it's in close range, he's got a lot better chance. But I just think Jamal Hill is going to find a way to kind of snipe him from the outside.
What do you think is at stake here? Like, I assume we're going to get the ankle I have in prayer rematch. I know they had talked to Jiří about a title shot. Jiří Prochazka didn't work out for him timing wise. Is the winner of this like behind there? Does the winner of this maybe get Carlos Ahlberg in a title eliminator or something like that?
Yeah, possibly. I think that the winner of this definitely has an opportunity to move up. The loser, you know, gets put into night watch status. You know what I'm saying? You watching the gate at night. You the gatekeeper for at nighttime. But right. The winner has the ability to move up and say, all right, there's still some potential left in them. So there is a lot at stake in this because there is no championship aspirations without a win on Saturday night for either guys.
Yeah, definitely not in the short term. I mean, light heavyweight is a pretty thin weight class, so anything can happen with a couple quality wins, but these guys definitely feel like the outside looking in. And who knows if Pereira wins, do they do a rematch or a trilogy with Ankalaev? Probably not. It'll be the Bob Muhammad thing where they push him back in the queue. We'll see.
Listen, if Pereira wins against Magomed Ankalaev, he going back on the prelims.
We'll see. Yeah, I'm hoping we get that one in October. There's some big fights I feel like we're getting in the second half of this year. It's all kind of coming together now, Dean.
Hey, I hope so, because That's what we want. That's what we all live off of. That's what all of us eat off of. And at the end of the day, we make all these complaints about there's too many fights, this, that, and there. That's a good problem to have. We all eat because of this. So if they can produce some good fights at the second half, we eating more. So UFC, let's go. I'm rooting for you. Let's go.
For sure. These next three pay-per-views, the headliners are incredible. We'll see what we end up getting in October. But the next one, Dean, we are about a week away from International Fight Week here. This is the cornerstone of the UFC schedule each year. And hell of a main event, especially with Ilya Topuria and Charles Oliveira. Some other good fights on that card. I talked to Pantoja. Earlier this week, he said Kai Kara-France is the Mike Tyson of flyweight. So I thought he at least threw something interesting out there to try to build the fight a little. But if I was to ask you, you look at UFC 317, what's the storyline that you're most eager to see unfold next week?
I mean, it really comes down to, at the end of the day, for long-term effect, can Ilya Topuria knock out Charles Oliveira and be a lightweight champion? And then if he does do that, where does that rank him in terms of GOAT status, Mount Rushmore? Because if you think about it, I mean, him knocking out Volkanovski and Max Holloway and winning the lightweight or the featherweight title, then if he moves up and knocks out a guy like Charles Oliveira at lightweight and becomes a lightweight champion, I mean, the accolades in itself are incredibly remarkable. And the timing in which he did it and how fast he did it, incredibly remarkable. If he can do that, to me, that would be for sure just one of the fastest ascensions to greatness that we've seen in MMA. I mean, very like Henry Cejudo-like.
Yeah, it might be the greatest three-fight winning streak in MMA or UFC history.
It would be such a crazy thing for that to happen. And I believe that a guy like Ilya set it up for that because I think he likes these type of challenges, and I think he likes to do great things, like big things that seem unattainable. Because if you were to ask anybody else, this is you couldn't predict that anybody would be able to do this to those three guys. And I think that's why he wants to do it.
Yeah, he's a beast, and this is history at stake for him too. I believe he would be the only fighter with an undefeated record to become a two division champion, right? I guess you could include John Jones in there if you don't really believe in the loss, but he officially has that O and would be the first guy to do it. Israel Adesanya tried, then he lost to Jan Błachowicz, so he's not in that group. But yeah, this would be clearly something very special. But so many questions around Ilya, right? Like, what did you make of the stuff of him kind of parting ways with some of his longtime coaches, as far as like,
yeah, I don't read too much into that. No, I don't read too much into that. Why not? Because we never really know what the relationship is like with coach and athlete. Sure. Because we hear the words coach and athlete, we automatically assume Tom Brady Bill Belichick. We automatically assume that there's this great relationship and these guys are buddy buddies and he got him and taught him everything he knew. I mean, that's in my opinion, like, I don't know the relationship. So I'm just speaking based off of what I would assume based on what I know about the story is that they came up together, but Ilya would have been great with or without the guys.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't these guys taught him everything he knew, and he was going to be great with or without him. Now, I'm not saying that they didn't help him and they didn't provide a place for him to train or provide some insight as to how to be a better fighter. But Ilya was going to be great with or without him, and which is why, like, he's able to part from him and they can still be cool, because I think that they understood it too. They're like, hey, this guy came in, he already had skills or he already had this potential. We gave him a place to train and showed him a few things, but this guy was going to be good with or without us. I think they understood it. He understood it, which is why they're cool still. And he's like, yo, I got some new guys I'm working with in a different city.
Yeah. And I think his brother is kind of his main coach anyways. Yeah. So I don't know how much.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And
yeah,
I tell this to fighters all the time, man. I was talking to Aljamain Sterling the other day. I said, man, having good training partners is so much more important than having coaches. Mm. Just having guys to drill with and work on is way more important than coaches, because coaches end up being babysitters and psychologists, and because fighters don't listen to a word they say anyway.
Right.
Having good training partners and guys like with you to for you to work on is even more important. So I think for Ilya, him and his brother, that's the duo. Him and his brother is the duo.
Yeah,
he ain't leaving his brother. You know what I'm saying? He not telling his brother.
If he does, back. Then maybe we. Yeah, can
he
be
moved.
Worried.
He moved to Madrid. It was like, bro, you coming with me? You know what I'm saying? That's the duo right there.
Yeah. Do you think what's the size difference going to look like when they get in there? Is that something we need to be more thoughtful of? Like, we see these photos coming out with Ilya standing next to Raul Rosas Jr. and he looks smaller.
Yeah, I know. I mean, sometimes that's a little forced perspective, but
sure,
Ilya is not a big guy anyway, but we put a little too much into like the idea of size without putting other factors involved in that. I think Ilya uses his smaller frame to his advantage. It makes him a smaller target. He defends better that way, and he's faster. And yeah, the fact that he's faster when he gets his feet in position to throw punches and he lands on your chin, the size of the chin is not an issue, right? That's not the issue. So I think that where a size can matter in this fight is if Charles Oliveira decides to wrestle. And same thing like Kamaru Usman, his arms are so long, his legs are so long. So if he decides to wrestle Ilya and he grabs Ilya and he gets around his legs, Ilya is going to have a hard time there. If he gets Ilya down, he's going to have a hard time getting out and just escaping the extremities of Charles Oliveira. I think that might be the biggest issue. But other than that, I think that Ilya's speed and his actual small size, making him a smaller target, should also come into play.
Yeah. Does this, on the flip side of it, my kind of storyline was about Charles Oliveira. Like, is this going to be his last chance at an undisputed UFC title? And he's got a wonky title history. I mean, I think he's going to be the third guy ever, or the first guy ever, to fight for three different vacant titles. Like, he's never fought the standing champion, right? Like, his first one, Michael Chandler for the vacant belt. He won it, defended it against Dustin Poirier. Then he fought Justin Gaethje, lost the title on the scale because he missed weight, which was a crazy thing. Then won that fight. It was not a title fight for him. And then he fought Islam for the vacant belt, lost that one, beat Beneil Dariush, lost to Armin Sarukian, beat Michael Chandler, and then now here he is for another vacant title fight against Ilya Topuria. So I don't know, like, this kind of broke in his favor with Islam moving up and like all that stuff. He was kind of in a tough spot with the loss to Armin and then pulling out of the rematch in Abu Dhabi with Islam that led to the Volkanovski rematch. So like, it's been a bit of a tough road here, but I don't know, like, with how much better lightweight is getting, the star Ilya could be, I worry if he doesn't get this done, this is kind of the end of that championship chapter of Charles Oliveira's career.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There's I can't see a path in which he loses this fight and then is able to work himself back up into another title fight. I don't see a path there. He's got to win this fight. Like, if he wants to be champion, he has to win this fight. And even though I just gave so much props to Ilya, there is a path of victory for him. I saw the odds on this and it's like 4-1 or something crazy like that. And I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? Now, I'm favoring Ilya, but like, to say that he beats him with that level of odds is crazy to me.
Yeah, I can't, like, Charles Oliveira is one of the greatest fighters in UFC history. We don't need to read all the bonuses or all the accolades. We know them, you know, the wins, the finishes, the bonuses. Like, he can beat anyone on the right night when he's popping, and he's had a good history, I feel like, against guys who just want to box him. We'll see what Ilya can mix in there. But, like, you know, the fight with Poirier, I know there was that stretch where he was getting knocked down. But if you're just not giving him a ton of different looks and just trying to strike with him, I feel like, you know, he definitely has a chance in any fight like that.
Well, if you notice, like, if you look at his last fight against Michael Chandler, he fought differently, like, mentally, and he fought a different structured type of fight. He was a lot more patient, a lot more calculated, and he was like, you know what? I'd normally get knocked down early in fights. It's crazy because, like, we all think about this, right? He always gets knocked down early in fights. He knows that. You know what I'm saying? That's not a surprise to him. So when he fought Michael Chandler that second time, he probably knew, hey, man, listen, I got to be more responsible earlier. And he fought that fight very responsibly early. And it wasn't until later that he got dropped. It wasn't until later that he found himself in trouble. But I think that has a lot to do with focus, because he's never really been in a long five-round war that way. So so for this fight, I expect him to actually not only – not get dropped in the first two rounds. I expect him to win the first two rounds.
That would be fascinating. I'd love to see it play out that way. And then Ilya is, you know, either got to get the finish or get those last three to secure the win. Last thing on UFC 317, Dean, we found out this week that for this title fight, Armin Sarukian will be the backup fighter. Does this mean he is out of the doghouse now?
No, I don't think it means he's out of the doghouse. I think he gets the consolation prize because Justin Gaethje will probably get the next shot.
Or he's retiring, apparently.
And he said, and Justin Gaethje said, I'm not cutting weight to be a backup.
Yeah.
I'm not cutting weight to be a backup. I want the title shot. And the UFC was like, all right, we'll do. All right. So we're not going to make you cut weight, because, like, Justin Gaethje should probably be the rightful owner of this position. But he's like, I'm not cutting weight to just be a backup. So I think by default, Armin Sarukian was the only guy they could go to for this. And Armin is going to do whatever he can to get himself out of the doghouse, had to say yes.
Yeah. No, and he said a few weeks ago in interviews he was willing to do this for this card, for the Holloway and Poirier fight as well. So it seems like he's at least taking the right mental approach to get himself back. So credit to you.
Well, you have to, because, like, when you start playing with fire with the UFC and you start, you know, that's the hand that feeds you. And when you start getting too close to biting it, you got to pull back a little bit and understand what's going on. And I think that's what happened, is that sometimes these guys get in a position where they start talking reckless and acting reckless. And then they realize that, hey, man, the show will go on with or without you. In fact, like, without you, you're going to see your buddies in the spotlight, and you're going to be real sad. So I think Armin Sarukian realized that and was like, whoa, I got to make sure that I stay in good graces.
Yeah, it's a question of how much you want this. And I think we're finding his answer by him doing this. Okay, Dean, that was thing three. Thing four, we're going to have a little fun here. A way too early fighter of the year discussion, Dean. We're almost at the midpoint of 2025, though. I asked you to see if, obviously, Merab Dvalishvili is the front runner right now. Only fighter to have two title fights, two title defenses. Very impressive stuff. But as we look ahead, maybe there's some people that could take it over. I don't know. I asked you to kind of look around the landscape, what's happened, what could happen. Is Merab the lock, or is there anyone?
No, he's not the lock. I actually think that if Jack ends up fighting Islam and beats him, depending on how that looks, that might be our fighter of the year, my man.
It might be. Okay, I want to play a little sliding doors game here with you, Dean, and you can answer to see who would come out on the top of the mountain here. There's some hypotheticals. Okay, so Merab has got the two title defenses. He beat Umar, he beat Sean O'Malley. Let's say he doesn't get the four. He just gets the three. He beats Corey Sandhagen in October or something. And that's his resume for the year, the three title defenses over those guys. I will give you another scenario, and you can tell me if it's better than Merab's or if we drop them off. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Okay. So if Alexander Volkanovski beats Movsar Ablyev after beating Diego Lopez, would he be ahead of Merab? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. If Renier DeRitter beats Robert Whittaker after beating Bo Nickel and Kevin Holland, would he be ahead of him? Yes or no?
Absolutely not.
If Megamed Ankalaev beats Alex Pereira for a second time twice in 1 year, would he be ahead?
No.
Okay, this is where it starts to get a little more difficult.
Okay.
If Ilya Topuria beats Charles Oliveira and then maybe either Paddy Pimblett or Justin Gaethje at the back end of the year, would he be ahead of him?
If he beats Gaethje, yes. Paddy, no.
Okay, interesting. So you put that's ahead.
If he beats Charles Oliveira and Gaethje in the same year, yes.
You think that's better than beating Umar, Sean O'Malley, and Corey Sandhagen? Those two wins?
Yes, because he moved up in weight to do it.
Okay, interesting. So we have Ilya Topuria as our number one guy there. Okay, so that Ilya Topuria resume, would Dricus du Plessis beating Khamzat Chimaev and Sean Strickland be better than that Ilya Topuria resume?
No.
No. Okay. As you alluded to there, if Jack Della Maddalena beats Islam Makhachev and Bilal Muhammad, would that be a better resume than the Ilya Topuria's wins?
Whew, man. Let me think. Yes. It would be. Yep. That would be it.
Jack Della Maddalena, maybe our fighter of the year if he gets the stunt.
If Jack Della Maddalena could beat, he already beat Bilal. If he could beat Islam Makhachev, he's the fighter of the year. And I don't think there's anything that can top that.
Okay. What about this one? I have one more for you, and it leads into our fifth thing here. If Tom Aspinall fights and beats John Jones, would that be ahead of Ilya's multiple wins? Just getting one win, beating the greatest fighter ever, is that enough to be have a better resume than all these guys, the biggest accomplishment of the year?
If Tom Aspinall can get the fight signed before the year's over, he's the fighter of the year.
Yes, that's true. But that's a tough one for me. I mean, obviously, these other guys might have one, two, or three wins. Tom's one win might exceed that if it happens. And we'll get into that next. But in that hypothetical scenario, is that better than Islam and Bilal?
No, on paper, it might seem like it's better, but it's not better. It wouldn't be better. To me, that's still down the list a little bit because we expect Tom to beat John Jones. He's supposed to beat John Jones.
I don't expect anyone to beat John Jones.
Yeah,
but I get
right. For sure. You don't really expect it, but I don't know. There's a path of victory there. But when you talk about Jack Della Maddalena, him beating Bilal Muhammad, there was very little path of victory we saw ahead of that. And then if he fights Islam, who is the pound for pound fighter, number one fighter in the world right now, if he beats him, that to me would be remarkable.
Yeah. Well, I honestly thought when I sent you this question, I'm like, this is an open and shut discussion. Like there's not really anyone that could exceed Marab, but as I went through the exercise, I'm like, a lot of people could have a really strong fighter of the year case. It would be incredible if all these things came to fruition. But yeah, Ilya Topuria seems like maybe could be that guy, back-to-back fighter of the year. That would be very impressive because he got promoted.
The way I see it, like with Ilya, like him moving up and then beating, like he's right now he's the favorite to beat Charles. So that's good. But if he beats Justin too, like that to me would be crazy.
Yeah. That would be fascinating. Okay. Well, I'm very excited to see all these potential fights play out now, Dean. But let's go into the last thing here. And it does play off what we were just discussing with John Jones and Tom Aspinall. I don't know, from stuff I've been hearing for like months now, I said this with Bisbing like over a month ago, I think when he was on, it sounds like if everything goes the way the UFC wants it, we will get an announcement of some sort during International Fight Week about what's happening at heavyweight. What that is, if it's Tom against someone else, if we get John somehow done, I don't know. But it seems like the saga is quickly coming to an end. What's the final verdict going to be? What's your read?
It's got to be John Jones. I think all this nonsense is just media. I mean, it's just, not media, it's marketing. I think it's marketing. I think it's marketing to keep it out there, to make it even bigger. You know, every show I've done, we talked more about John Jones and Tom Aspinall.
I know.
And we've talked about a fight that wasn't even signed more than fights that happened. And I think that was done purposely. I think John Jones is going to fight. He has to. There's no way like he goes this route and does all this and then not fights. I think it's all marketing to keep it out there to make it even bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is going to end up getting signed. And then it's going to be the big fight that the UFC needs to close out the year.
Interesting. I love the positivity. This is very good. This is what we all needed today, Dean, because I think it's very grim in the eyes of many. But I don't know, like, if this is all marketing, was it the right strategy, I guess?
And it's the right strategy, too, because Think about this. If John Jones and Tom Aspinall, like, if the plan was to have them fight in November or December, and then we announced it in February, like, no one would talk about it until then.
Yeah, or get fatigued of it.
Yeah, we get tired of talking about it. But the idea of John Jones hinting around, Tom Aspinall calling him a duck, John Jones hinting and saying this, that, and then it just really kept us dangling. They just kept that carrot dangling in front of us, and we'd reach for it, and then we'd go, oh. And then they bring it back out, and we reach for it, and we go, oh. But I think now's about the time where they can make a really strong announcement, and we'll go, yes, we got. It's like a movie, right? It's like a movie. Like, the guy's trying to get the girl, and he can't get her, and she's with another dude, and he can't get her. And then at the end of the movie, he finally gets her, and we're all happy about it, right? So, like, that's what this is.
Yeah, I hope so. I just hope so many people haven't been turned off, like, off on it through all this. I know Chael Sonnen, like, he was on the show a couple weeks ago. He said videos he makes about this, things he puts out, like, they aren't drawing crap. No one seems to care anymore. I don't know if I fully agree with that. I think once you announce it, you would get all of that back.
You get it all back, right? You get it all back. Because he's right, though. There is a time where we start losing hope. There's only so many times that you can dangle that carrot.
Well, especially John's out there saying, you know, like, take the belt away, I don't care. Like, I don't know. Did you watch all of Dana's comments from the press conference in Newark, where he seemed, you know, kind of all over the place as far as, like, what was going on with John and all that type of stuff? Is this all gamesmanship as well?
It's got to be gamesmanship, because that's what's going to make the announcement even bigger. Because we start, like, we had hope, we lose hope. We have hope, we lose hope. And now, just when it hits rock bottom, John Jones, Tom Aspinall, officially signed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yes, it's going to happen. Yes.
What did you make of Francis Ngannou kind of being around there? I know he was there to support Usman, but, like, he wasn't an official cornerman, and they let him go up on stage there with all the UFC gear at the weigh-ins. Is everyone reading too much into this? I think he still is under contract with PFL, but, like, there's been more Francis Ngannou back to the UFC talk than we've heard since he left.
Yeah, but let's talk about that for just a second.
Yeah.
All right. Yes. Francis Ngannou, this is the man who, when he left the UFC, oh, I don't like the fighter pay. I don't like the way they treat the fighter. I don't like this and that. I'm doing this for you guys. Where is that guy at? Where is that dude? Yeah. Now Francis is entertaining the idea of coming back. Homie, the fighter pay ain't changed. The healthcare ain't changed. None of that changed.
Not that stuff, no. His fighter pay might.
His did.
Change. He could maybe get more.
He went out and got paid.
Yeah.
But I thought he was doing this for the people. None of that changed. And now he's coming back.
Well,
I knew what this was in the beginning. And Francis is a great fighter, a great dude, but he is not a martyr to MMA. And let's never, ever try to put him in that position again to say that he was doing something to help fighters out, because that was not the case.
Sure. I would push back a little bit. I think he had good intentions, but it's very difficult in the sport to create actual change foundationally like that. I mean, we see all the stuff. He was supposed to be a spokesperson for fighters in PFL. Like, I've seen a few issues come up and some fighters have tagged him. There hasn't been, like, a statement or anything on behalf of that.
I'm probably being a little unfair, but, you know, this is for TV. So.
No, I know what you're saying. I don't disagree with, like, the harsh stance on it too, but yeah, at the end of the day, everyone needs to look out for number one in this business.
Hey, I got no problem with that, because I'm damn sure looking out for me. You know what I'm saying? But that's how I would have approached it in the beginning. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, it's just unfortunate how it fell apart. You know, I think there's some fault on his end. You know, UFC Dana maybe could have played nicer in some spots, but it sounds like Hunter Campbell did really do all his best to keep this guy in the octagon and get that fight done. But yeah, well, John Jones wasn't wanting to do it at the time either, so we can't forget that.
So to answer your question, are we reading too much into it?
Yes.
I think so. I think that, you know, if he's still under contract with PFL, there's probably a very limited chance, small chance that the PFL is going to let him go so that he can fight in the UFC. I don't know what his deal looks like, but yeah, I can't imagine that being
him. I really don't know.
Yeah. I can't imagine what that looks like though.
But man, I guess just lastly on this, if John Jones, for whatever reason, did retire, he's done. We aren't getting this fight. Fucking Tom Aspinall versus Francis Ngannou would be a hell of a way to salvage things.
It would be. It would be. If that happens, that would be the way to go. I would absolutely love that. I might like that from a competition standpoint, not like a marketing, but a competition standpoint. Yeah, yeah. I would probably prefer that be the fight for me.
It'd be fascinating. It's a shame we can't live in a world where we could have got all of them. John and Tom, Francis and John, Francis and Tom, all that stuff. But
I know, man.
We might only get one.
I wish it
was. Or we might just get Tom versus Cyril gone.
I wish it was like the Pride days when we made all the big fights happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. I'm hoping that it does happen. But if the John Jones fight does not happen and we end up getting Francis Ngannou, that's actually even a better fight to me.
How will you feel if it does end up being Jailton Almeida or Cyril Gane versus Tom for like the undisputed belt and John retires?
Oh, man. That would be disappointing. That would be beyond disappointing, actually, from a marketing standpoint, from a landscape of where the UFC is at the standpoint. That would be a complete pay-per-view disaster.
Yeah, that would be we'd see the strength of the UFC brand at Madison Square Garden if that ends up being, because you could argue, all respect to Tom, but he has never headlined a pay-per-view. So plopping him at the top of Madison Square Garden against Cyril Gane, I think would be tough, but we'll see what they can do.
Man, that would be tough. I mean, you'd have to have that undercard like super, super stacked.
For sure. Second title fight, all that stuff. Yeah. But we could talk about this for days, Dean. We've been talking about this for months or almost a year at this point. Hopefully, I'm just praying we're at the finish line and next week we get an announcement. I don't even care what it is at this point. Just give us direction, give us future, let all these heavyweights figure out what the hell they're fighting for as well. So we'll see. We got Curtis Blaydes on fighting a newcomer in Baku coming off a title fight. This is where we stand at this point at heavyweight. So, or just take my idea and merge heavyweight and light heavyweight. I will keep saying it, but that's a whole other talk.
Not a bad idea.
All right, dude. I appreciate you being here so much. Once again, on the Bonfire, man, keep killing it. Do your thing at Sirius on the UFC broadcasts and everywhere else you are. And we'll see you back here soon, dude.
All right, my man. Peace out.
All right. Thank you, brother.
Later.
And that does it for another episode of the Bonfire Podcast. Thank you to Dean for his time. That was a lot of fun. He has a busy day ahead right before 3 hours of radio for the man. So a lot of talking for Dean Thomas, but I love when he is here talking to me because I think we try to keep it real as much as possible for you guys. We'd be curious to know what you thought of our little Fighter of the Year game there. Was Dean right if all those fights play out? Was I right? I don't know. I think there's some fascinating potential opportunities for a lot of fighters coming off the back end of the year. As we talked about, first half of the year schedule, come see, come saw. Second half of the year is looking amazing. Hopefully these fights stay intact. Hopefully they make the big ones that they're trying to make. A lot of stuff going on behind the scenes at the UFC. So I think we are in good shape if the second half of 2025 shapes up as good as the first half. But first half will close out next week with UFC 317. I will not be there for the first time in a long time. I think this is the end of a 12-year streak of international fight weeks for me. Some personal stuff going on. Could not make it, but we will have great on-site coverage from Ken Hathaway, the MMA Junkie Radio team, and then whatever else we can do on top of that from home. It's a little different, but I will make sure to bring you guys the goods. Interview with Charles Oliveira coming in a few days on MMA Junkie as well, and many, many others. We are on a roll there. Lots of content coming out. So I appreciate all the support from everyone out there watching UFC 317 Fight Week episode of The Bonfire next week. We'll figure out who to have on for that, but hopefully it will be something special for you all. And then on the back end of that, have some great mid-year content ideas for you all. So I appreciate you tuning in. Once again, please make sure to like, subscribe, rate, comment. Shout out to my man, Abhi Subban Kamikaze, for producing the program as always. And until next week, I will see you all back here by the bonfire.